Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Journey to Success Radio Network. This is the first show of 2013. Our purpose on Journey to Success Radio is to interview people who are making a difference in the world. We explore important aspects and areas of life, including business, sales, physical, mental, relationships, disabilities, and many more interesting topics. Our broadcast team so far consists of outstanding people from both Canada and the U.S., including several Napoleon Hill certified instructors, as well as several authors. My name is Tom Tutall Cunningham, and I'm a Napoleon Hill Foundation certified instructor. I'm also a regular contributor to their weekly e-zine, and I spoke in March 2012 at the Napoleon Hill International Convention in Malaysia, where I shared the stage with Deepak Chopra, who was the keynote speaker for that event. I've had rheumatoid arthritis from my jaw to my toes since the age of 5. That's 44 years now. And in that time, I've had 4 hips, 4 knees, and 2 shoulders replaced and been hospitalized about 40 times. I also stand about 5'1". That's due to the heavy daily doses of the oral steroid prednisone that I had to take to fight my arthritis. Despite those physical challenges, I'm well known for always answering amazing when asked how I'm doing. I'm also a senior research director for the Canadian Business Journal, which is a digital-only publication, and we're the official and only media partner of the Canadian Chamber of Commerce. You can find out more about me at my website, mrpma.ca. My guest today is Scott Seiferlein. Scott is a speaker, a writer, and a golf coach, and he has shared his golf secrets with hundreds of thousands of golfers around the world. He has helped golfers of all levels and professions, even a few dozen celebrities. Scott's 19 years in the business include coaching golfers in Michigan, South Carolina, New York, and Florida, and he currently coaches golfers at the prestigious Watermark Country Club located in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Scott has recently presented for numerous golf outings and corporate events, including Big Breakfast in Fort Lauderdale, at Davenport University, U Club in Grand Rapids, Michigan, Mary Free Bed, Ferris State University, and numerous others. He's while holding the top instructor position at Middle Bay Country Club, Scott was featured in Donald Trump's book, The Best Golf Advice I Ever Received. Scott has been featured on Grand Rapids Fox 17 television, WZZM TV 13, Take 5 and Company, and numerous radio, newspaper, and magazine outlets. He's a 2-time published author of The Game of Golf and the Art of Business and Stop Slicing in 5 Swings, and is currently publishing his 3rd book, 19 Holes of Business Golf Conversation. Scott's feature speaking engagement is titled 3 Lessons from the Game of Golf That Apply to the Art of Business. This entertaining keynote captures audiences with fun golf stories as well as valuable content. Welcome to the show today, Scott.
Thank you very much, Tom. I'm honored to be your first guest of 2013.
And you are my first golf-related guest, and my goodness, golf is a prominent discussion in my family. My mother golfs, my father golfs, my sister golfs, my brother-in-law golfs, and a lot of their discussion in golfing periods or golfing months are about golf. And so what an interesting topic. And then, of course, it ties so well to business because so many businessmen also have it as a hobby or a sport that they play. So it'll be interesting to talk to you about that. But as you know, I like to always start my show whenever possible by asking, what age were you when you first read the book Think and Grow Rich? And was there anyone special in your life that suggested that you read the book?
No, unfortunately, I wasn't able to read that book until I was, I believe, 25 years old. I'm trying to do the math here, but and I was exposed to the book through some other self-development books, not through anyone personally. But when I was 22, I was given the book Unlimited Power by Anthony Robbins.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was the first self-development book that I had been given. It was a graduation gift to me when I graduated from college. One of the alumni had given this book to all the graduates of the program, the professional golf management program that I had gone through. And that was the first book. And then through that book, I started to get engaged in some self-development and in other books. And that's when I found, a few years later, then I found the Napoleon Hill book, Think and Grow Rich. And that's still on my bookshelf today with many pages flipped and marked and dedicated.
Yeah. And that Unlimited Power, what a powerful book to start with. That is an amazing book as well that I have so many highlights in, and just a powerful book. And no matter how many books, if you read at least 10 or 15 personal development books, quite a number of them will point you or mention somewhere in it about Think and Grow Rich. And so you can't read too many personal development books without hearing of the book Think and Grow Rich a few times. And so that's where a lot of people find it, is reading other authors' books who mention Think and Grow Rich. And so, good story. Now, Scott, you live a life that a lot of people I know would love to live. They would trade places with you in a jiffy. And yet I think of people that would think that, and yet I think of the, forget the book that mentions the 10,000 hours of practice required to master a hobby, a sport, a business, a skill. How old were you when you started your 10,000 hours of golfing practice?
I was 10 years old when I was first exposed to the game, and just an initial exposure that first year, but didn't go out on the course until I was 11, and then was hooked from that point on.
And that's not a sport that every, let's say, North American kid would pick as their first sport. And so I imagine there weren't too many 11-year-olds on the golf course when you were golfing.
No, there wasn't. I created some games and oftentimes would either play with adults, which was an amazing experience as an 11, 12, 13-year-old, and you play with adults and you grow up fast. It was really great for my maturity and experiencing that ultimately helped me later on get through college and in my early part of my professional career. But it wasn't I wouldn't say it was my first sport. I was very active in baseball prior to being exposed to golf, and golf was, I would say, was my second sport. I played other sports as well. I was very active athletically through high school. But golf has stuck with me, and I went after high school. I went and participated as a member of the collegiate team at Ferris State University. We're a Division II school, and we finished eighth place in the nation 3 years in a row. We were the best team in North Georgia for 3 years in a row. We just couldn't quite tackle those Southern teams that played all year and really drew the talent. But those were some great years, good experiences. And then after college, then I started to play some mini-tour events through Florida and club professional events in Michigan, and then again in New York when I was out teaching golf in New York. So it's still with me today.
Yeah, yeah. And so when I read that intro and the bio, it appears that you've really found your definite purpose. And as you know, Napoleon Hill, that's the number one success principle, is definiteness of purpose. But perhaps maybe your definiteness of purpose started as golf, and then it's evolved into being an author and a speaker as well. When did you find out, or how did you progress to the point of using golf to earn money and then deciding, I'm a good writer, I have some things I can write about? How did your definite purpose evolve from just loving golf to where you are today?
Yes, it's interesting that you bring that up. I have the words definiteness of purpose are on my big whiteboard in my indoor coaching studio for all my clients to see. And when I was in school, they tell you that you need to decide what you want to be in life, and they send you to a guidance counselor. And I didn't know what I wanted to be, and I was working as a 16, 17-year-old. I was working at a golf course, and I thought, well, that's fun, and I like to play golf, too. So there was a professional golf management school, one of only four in the country, at Ferris State University, and it was convenient, 3 hours away from home, in-state tuition. And so that's what I said that I wanted to do. The guidance counselor kind of looked at me like I had three heads. and he tried to convince me to look at some other options. But after I toured the school and met the coordinator of the program, I thought that was definitely the direction that I wanted to go. And I thought I would stay with that until maybe I grew up, I guess. I wasn't really sure, but I was. And then fortunately, I had a very good internship my second year on campus that exposed me to some really super people in the golf industry who taught golf for a living. And that's when I started to gain an interest in teaching for a living. So I pursued that through the rest of my internships and my first few assistant jobs. In fact, the second job I took as a professional was basically a full-time teaching position out in Long Island. And then that's actually how I was exposed to the Trump Organization, and then it ended up being featured in one of Donald's books. But to go on with that story, after that experience, I decided that I wanted to start my own coaching business and move my family back to Michigan where we could raise kids and be closer to my parents and my wife's parents. And so we moved back here to Michigan. I started my own coaching business with no prior experience of running a business, no clients. I didn't know people in the town we chose here, Grand Rapids, Michigan. So I learned a lot about building a business over those first few years, because I would have starved if I didn't. And I was forced into learning how to do direct response marketing, how to do guerrilla style type marketing, build a business from scratch. And then after a few years of building that business, I really gained an interest in developing a book about business and golf, and was exposed and introduced to a publisher in a nearby town here that I'm still working with today. He helped me publish my first book, The Game of Golf and the Art of Business. And we're currently working on my third book that has to deal with conversations that you would have with people on the golf course and how to direct a business round of golf. So that's a fun project that we're working on right now. But through the publishing of the book, then that opened up speaking opportunities. You know, Tom, I had been attempting to do speaking prior to writing the book, but my speech, my presentations were always golf instructional related. And I was finding that, for the most part, the companies, corporate lunch and learns, and people that would hire keynote speakers, they didn't want people to talk about golf instruction. So I was having a hard time gaining speaking opportunities. But with the book and the stories from the book and how it relates to business and golf, now it's really opened up some doors for me, and I've had some opportunities to speak for some good-sized CPA firms, financial advisor firms, and I've got a couple insurance firms that I've got upcoming speaking engagements in the next couple of months. So it's really opened up some doors, and that's kind of a long story back to your original question of how I got into your
so interesting,
offering.
Though. It's like you started with a kind of a basic, definite purpose, which for a young person, you're not going to really have all the details filled in when you're too young, but you started with golf, and then you had to, through experience, found out you enjoyed the teaching part. And there's one thing about learning that you enjoy something is another thing about learning if you are good at it. And so obviously you have some skill at that because that business progressed. And then so just with starting with that basic purpose as a young person, you've evolved it into learning the profession of coaching and writing and now speaking because of it. And so cool. And then I think of your guidance counselor. I guess they're kind of restricted. Maybe, I don't know, I think another guy interviewed his daughter. I think she was like 12, and they had a project, you know, what are you going to do with your life? And he's in a network marketing business. He makes well over $100,000 a month. So this 12-year-old said, oh, I'm going to be a top position earner in network marketing and earn over $100,000 a month. And the teacher gave her an F.
Wow.
She said, if you don't, that's not possible. So if you don't change it, I'm going to give you an F. So her dad had said, he said, sweetie, that's the best F you're going to ever earn. And so I'm proud of, I'm proud
answer.
Of you. Don't change your purpose. And so, yeah, I guess, you know, your guidance counselor probably doesn't have a lot of people come up and say they're going to be involved in golf as a profession for the rest of their life. So cool.
No,
now, another thing. Another thing I remember interviewing your friend Scott Duffy, and he was talking about being an entrepreneur, and this is what you are, kind of. You certainly are an entrepreneur as well as a golfer, and you talked about moving closer to both your wife and your parents. And Napoleon Hill talks about the best mastermind is with a husband and a wife, and so you must have. You must have a wife who doesn't mind the ups and downs of being an entrepreneur. You know, you often have to work strange hours, do all kinds of things, and so you must have found that balance as well.
Oh, well, you'll have to ask her about that. I don't know if she would have the same. I don't know if she would have the same answer. There's obviously every entrepreneur has many challenges. And balancing family and life and business is certainly one of them. There is, I remember Ivan Meisner, the founder of BNI, he was asked about how does he find balance. And he had a great answer for that. He said, there is no balance. There's no such thing as balance. I seek to find harmony. I thought that was an outstanding answer and very much related to what I try to do with my family, and because things aren't equal, they don't stay the same. They constantly change and evolve.
Yes, and I remember reading a book called Full Engagement. Might be a longer title than that, but it was talking about how you can be really, really busy for a period of time, and then you slow down for a period of time, and so life goes up and down like that, and so it's always a continuing balancing act where it's okay to be too far on one side or the other as long as you get to the middle once in a while. And
right.
So
one nice thing about being in the golf business in Michigan, anyways, is that to some degree seasonally, I do coach indoors, but it's not as busy as the outdoor season. And then I take 2 months off from seeing clients from a coaching standpoint. I take November and December off, so that I'm able to recalibrate and work on the business model, work on the business plan, spend time with family, create that harmony. And that's been just outstanding.
Wow. That's a great feature of where you are and what you do. Now, being mentioned in Donald Trump's book, I think if I was ever mentioned in a Donald Trump's book, that anyone who looked at me sideways would know about it. I would be telling everybody. That is pretty cool. How did that happen? Because there are a lot of people who could be in that book.
Well, it started out, the Trump Organization sent out a request to, I would imagine I was on a list of golf pros that they had my name on a list. They sent out a request that they were developing this book on coaching, and it was going to be Donald Trump's self-titled book, Trump, the Best Golf Advice I Ever Received. And I submitted a piece that they could include in the book, but I just didn't think twice of it and forgot about it. And the only other thing I did, I happened to be teaching George Ross at the time, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with George Ross or not, but he was he's Trump's right-hand man. He's Trump's chief negotiator.
Oh, yes.
Now,
I remember him from the show The Apprentice.
And right. If you're familiar with the show The Apprentice, that would be George Ross.
Nice.
And he was at a private club, Middle Bay Country Club, that I was teaching golf at the time. And I wrote him a letter, and I said, if you happen to, if you're familiar with this book project I submitted, something for it, and I never heard back from him, so I didn't think anything of it. And then a year later, a pro friend of mine out in Long Island called me up and said, hey, I was at the bookstore and your name was in this book, and he featured you in a chapter, and so I had to go check it out. lo and behold, there it was. It was already on the bookshelves, and I didn't even know about it. But it's a fun book. It's Trump, the best golf advice I ever received, and he has celebrities in the book. He has broadcasters. He has professional athletes from other sports. He also has professional PGA Tour players. And then he has a series of golf instructors in there, and we all provide him some golf advice. Now, some of it's serious, some of it's not so serious. I think Yogi Berra was in there, and he had something along the lines of the best advice he ever received was when he was told to be confident. And he said, well, I am confident. I'm confident my ball is going to go in the water. So some of it is humorous, and some of it is valuable, very valuable golf advice. My chapter happens to be next to Phil Simms' chapter. Phil Simms,
nice.
Quarterback of the New York Giants.
New York
Giants. Championship Super Bowl team of the early 90s.
And what a funny way to learn that you're mentioned in the Donald Trump book. Have someone
right.
else tell you.
Yep. So they had about 140 or so contributors to this book, and I guess they just didn't reach out to everyone that they had, or I had moved at the time, so maybe they no longer had my correct information. But it was fun to experience that and find
nice,
out stuff
yeah.
in that book.
That's a nice little kudos to have. And then also in your bio, you've coached a few dozen celebrities, and I don't know if they let you say who they are, but like, what was that? Maybe even like the first time that a celebrity came to you for coaching, that must be kind of neat or cool or like, wow. And then at the same time, I think of a saying my dad always told me, because I used to have to contact very high profile presidents, and he used to tell me that everybody puts their pants on one leg at a time, meaning that we're all basically the same. And so what was it like to get that first celebrity coaching contract, and then also, did you find that of the people, the celebrities you've coached, are they just basically put their pants on one leg at a time, regular nice people like everybody else?
Deep down, psychologically, they have the same amount of troubles, if not more troubles than we do. So it's, they're lying awake at night staring at the ceiling wondering how they're going to stop their slice just as much as the next guy. So that's it wasn't too big of a deal. And the other thing is on my internships, I had the opportunity to watch and observe other coaches coach well-known, successful, celebrity types of people. And that experience helped, just being involved in that, not necessarily having the responsibility to help them directly with their game, but just being able to observe and watch. I remember one experience with Yvonne Lendl, who was the number one ranked tennis player in the world in 1985. And he was working with a coach out in Westchester County, New York, in the late 90s, and I got to observe that experience and just interact with them. It's amazing how much confidence an athlete like that has. They whatever they're doing, they feel like they're going to be the best.
Yeah, and I guess they are so fit and so athletic that they have so much confidence probably in their body and its ability to do whatever is required.
Right, so they're amazing specimens and have a lot of confidence. But again, they still have the same worries deep down that the average person has. So that experience helped. And then, you know, frankly, several of the celebrities that I worked with, I didn't even realize they were celebrities, because they were in situations where they're dressed down. You don't necessarily recognize them because they don't have the makeup that they had on TV.
Yeah.
And they just want to be treated like a regular person. They don't want anything different. And it comes down to, I'm in a profession where people hire me for my professional advice. It doesn't matter whether they're a celebrity or not. They want me to be focused and earn my money. So that's what I do. Mm-hmm. I go to work.
Exactly, exactly. And they're, you know, as you said, they have the same challenges, but they're also probably, you know, just regular people. And I like what you said, that you didn't even know some of them were celebrities. And I love people like that who have some claim to fame, but who, if they're walking around town, you would never know it. And, you know, they don't have any, you know, bodyguards or fanfare or people going ahead telling everybody who they are. So I really love people like that. And it's really nice to hear that, you know, that's how celebrities are. Now, your book and your speaking engagement, Three Lessons from the Game of Golf That Apply to the Art of Business. Can you go through those three lessons briefly?
Yes, and they are captured from some of the chapters in my book. One of them is highlighting the process of grinding, how to grind out a score in tough conditions, how to grind out a profit during economic challenges. And we relate the two. We relate to how we would benefit from grinding in the in our golf game, and how we would benefit from grinding in our profession or our business.
How do we do some grinding in our business?
And, well, as it, I mean, I don't know how much you want me to get into my actual presentation, but I take some stories that I've experienced on the golf course, both personally and with clients, and how we have to stay focused on the process. And sometimes things go bad, but we have to continue to be professional and keep our control our emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And things ultimately work out in the end. Then I also talk about a topic, perceptions, and how our perceptions are often not reality. So in golf, we have the saying, feel is not real, because what you feel in your golf swing is really, you film it, is really not what's happening. And we have, I highlight the perception of alignment in one of my chapters in my book. And then for my presentation, I share some stories of clients that I've worked with, and where they perceive that they were aligned is not where they're actually aligned. And then in our business, you know, if I stood behind you in your business as an outside observer and saw where you were aligned, is that really where you think you're aligned? Or are you in reality 5%, 10% offline? You know, it's so easy to be taken offline by the next shiny object, the next advertising guy that comes in and wants to sell you something. I remember just last year, it's been over a year now, someone came in with a shiny object, and I gave them some money to be exposed to their database, allegedly, and that mistake cost me several thousand dollars and off my annual income. Because I fell for that shiny object. And those things happen sometimes. We have to be careful. Those are perceptions of where we need our business to be aligned are not always where reality is actually taking us.
Yes. Nice.
And then the last topic I like to talk about in my keynote is I talk about the myth that about keeping your head down. I talk about the myth of swing speed and some of the other mythical golf advice, mythical golf tips that are out there that people tell you that you think you, or they think you, that you need to do that to play successfully, but the good players don't actually do that. And
I've heard keep your head down like a gazillion times.
Right. I mean, it's very common knowledge that you're supposed to do that, but through high-speed video and technology, I've discovered that the good players don't try to keep their head down. If they do, they do, but it doesn't really matter. There's good players that don't do it. In fact, some of the best players in the world have not kept their head down. Yet when we look at amateur players, they all have their head down. I've yet to meet anyone that's looked up. I filmed over 3,000 golfers that say that they look up before or had impact, and their friends have said that, but they don't. So now, it's a myth that that's related to good golf. And then I highlight some of the advice that business owners get that's just not true. And it's a myth. So there's some fun stories and then some application within that presentation.
I love that last one. I was just listening to the Law of Success audio program, and I'm on the principle of accurate thought. So accurate thought goes along with some of these falsehoods that we just accept as truth. And we really have to examine anything we accept as truth or believe ourselves, because it certainly can make a difference in our lives. Tell me about give me a story about your favorite success story.
Oh, my favorite success stories are always when my clients have hole-in-ones. I mean,
nice.
What's better than that?
The perfect
golf experience is a hole-in-one. But I'll tell you one recently that I had this past summer. I had a client come to me, and he's a retired business professional in the Grand Rapids area, and he was scoring in the mid to high 50s for 9 holes. And it was he has never broken 95 for 18 holes, but it was his dream to do just that. And I customized a coaching program for him, a 6-week coaching program that was very intensive. It required 27, 28 hours a week approximately of dedication.
Wow.
To his golf game. Now, 10 of those were strictly practice routines and training, and then 15 of those were training on the actual golf course, and then I had another 3 hours of golf fitness-related projects that he had to complete each week. And so we're going along, and then I would see him personally each week to see how his progress was going. And we had this very dedicated plan. It wasn't just you have to go and practice 10 hours a week. He had specific areas of his game and specific things to do to practice that were in 30-minute segments, hour-long segments that composed those 10 hours of practice each week. It was very intense, and he had an accountability scorecard that he had to fill out and get back to me to confirm that he was doing each of these steps. And there's many steps to this process of going through teaching him how to grind out the success, because he wouldn't grind out his shots. If things were going bad, he would just quit too easily. He had many perceptions that were off, that weren't real. So we took him through some of those and gave him some more real information about how to really hit good golf shots and control, especially around the short game. He really struggled with the short game. And then some of the myths that he had received about what his golf ball does and how it creates backspin, we covered some of those and gave him some factual information about that. And then I set him loose to train. 5 weeks into it, he was very frustrated. He had not even come close to breaking 95. And there's a book, you're probably familiar with the book, 3 Feet from Gold.
Ah, yes.
Aaron Lecter and Greg Reed.
Greg Reed.
And that book is, I'm told, is based on Napoleon Hill's book, The Think and Grow Rich book.
Mm-hmm.
But I look at it as it's really about not giving up. And my client was basically, 5 weeks in, he was so frustrated. He's put all this work into it. And he didn't know it, but he was 3 feet from gold. He just didn't know it yet. And I convinced him to keep grinding out the process of going through these practice routines and all the training that I had him doing on course and for golf fitness. And then in week 6, he completely broke through. He was out with his usual playing partners, and he just shocked them by scoring a 90. So not only did he break 95, but he smashed that. I mean, he beat it by 5 shots, and he told me he had a putt on the last hole to score an 89. So he almost broke 90 as well. He just missed that putt on the last hole and just completely broke through. But, you know, I mean, he could have easily quit during week 5. But we kept grinding away and focusing on the process, and that resulted in a great success.
Wow, and it must be an amazing process, because to take that many points off your game in 6 weeks is pretty powerful. A lot of people go numerous years without ever being able to take that many strokes off their game.
Yes. Yep. It's a very specific process. I have score-based coaching programs where the coaching program is set to allow the client to achieve a certain score in a predetermined time period, generally 6 weeks, but sometimes we custom design them. So I call them breaking 90 or breaking 80, whatever your score-based goal happens to be. In his case, it was breaking 95. And we went out and did an assessment on the course, and even though he was far from reaching that goal, when we did the assessment, I found areas of his game where I really thought that he could make drastic improvements. So I did accept him into that program. The program has a money-back guarantee, so I don't just accept anybody.
Wow. And so they must have to do the homework, too, because if it has money-back guarantee, you got to do the work.
Oh, yeah. That's the accountability side of it is involved, yes, absolutely. But he did it, and stayed focused on the process, and it worked just like it was designed to work.
Nice. Now you have another book called Stop Slicing in 5 Swings. Now, what percentage is it? A much higher percentage of people who slice than hook?
Way higher percentage, yes. It's a big, big problem in the game of golf, I would say.
What is slicing? What is slicing, and why do more people do it than hooking?
Great question. Slicing is a ball flight that if you're a right-handed player, it starts out generally to the left of the target and then curves, makes a drastic turn to the right.
Mm-hmm.
That's a true slice. Some people call that a pull slice because it starts out left, pulled to the left, and then makes its way back to the right. Now, it's just opposite. If you're a left-hander, it starts out to the right and curves violently to the left.
And is that, like you said, a higher percentage?
Right. Even when once it's done curving and it lands on the ground, then that side spin kicks it even farther offline. So it's just it just keeps going offline. That's why people lose sleep over it at night.
What part of the swing or what part of people that would make such a high percentage of them slice rather than hook?
There are 4 major reasons why people slice. And I discovered them through high-speed video and some 3D technology that I have. And I generally find that most slicers use 1 to 2 of those factors they've implemented in their game, consciously or unconsciously, either through bad advice or just because they just unconsciously did it.
Neat.
And usually I don't find anybody that has all 4 slice factors. Once in a while, 3, but mostly they have 1 or 2. And once I'm able to diagnose which is the most predominant, I can almost always, in fact, one of my slogans or guarantees is that you stop slicing in 5 swings guaranteed.
Yeah, that was my next question. Why 5? Why not 4 or 7 or under 10?
There's a long marketing story behind that one. But
Oh, okay.
Because I'm
it's
able
a marketing
to do it in
one.
5. Because I'm able to do it in 5. And sometimes it's less. I mean, I've had people do it in 1 swing. I've had people do it 2, 3, 4. But it's slicing in 5 swings. No more slicing in 5 swings is my guarantee. So I give them in case they don't get it on the 1st or 2nd swing, I give them a couple extra.
Okay. So it's a process, and there's some marketing behind the number 5 as well. Not that you've actually done like 3,000 and said, okay, 5 is the number. It's like you could do it in 2 or you could do it in 3, but you want to say 5.
Right.
Very good. Okay, I always like to know where numbers come from, numbers person, so very good. And now, are you a self-published author? How did you go about writing a book? Is this something that comes naturally, just go retreat to your office and start writing? How did you learn that process? No?
It's certainly not natural for me whatsoever. I've been desiring to write a book for some years now. As I was building my business, I thought, you know, it'd be great to have a business golf book of some sort. But I just didn't know how to do it. And I'm a busy professional sometimes. And in season, I'm working 14, upwards of 15, 16 hours a day sometimes. And there was just no time to write a book. But 2 years ago, 2011, I was introduced to Greg Smith of Black Lake Press. And he has a company that's basically a hybrid publishing company where they'll assist you with the process of developing your book. I had the storylines in place And I just met with him, and he said, here's how we turn this into an actual book. I had a lot of words on paper, but it just didn't logically fit. And he was outstanding in helping me put that together. And
joined
forces
with
me.
What are they called again?
Black Lake Press.
Neat.
And,
now, you have some interesting covers on your books, too. Did they help you with that?
And they helped with that. They did the cover design, and they helped me with all the ins and outs of publishing, as far as getting it on Amazon and Barnes and Noble and press releases, promotional flyers. They helped me develop the PowerPoint slides for my speaking engagements. So they've been a tremendous help.
Wow, isn't it cool how when you are working on your definite purpose, that truly is your definite purpose, that the right people and organizations just show up to help you do it as well as you can? Sounds like Black Lake Press is one of those that because you're focusing on your purpose, the universe arranges for you to make the right contacts.
Right, and your key words there were because you're focusing on your purpose. Those are key words. I mean, Black Lake Press wouldn't have just shown up if I wasn't focused on writing a book. But because I was, and I attended networking events, and I took all the right steps, then I finally met someone who said, you know, I'm writing a book right now, and I'll introduce you to my ghostwriter and my publisher. And so that's how it happened.
Wow. And it must be a different process, or interesting, or maybe even a difficult process to transfer what you do as a coach one-on-one to words in a book. Those are two different things, one-on-one, someone right there beside you, to putting what you do in a book. And that's probably a new skill that you had to learn as well.
Right, and we talked about that. We said, you know, there's a lot of golf instruction books out there, so anybody can do that. There's just tons of them. But there's very few business golf books that are in a story format. And so we wanted to do that, take that angle, and Black Lake Press helped me achieve that angle, so that it wasn't just, you know, I've got articles of how to swing a golf club, but so does everybody else, and there's enough instruction books. So that was unique, and then we took that new angle, and so it's the only business golf book that I'm aware of that takes someone on a journey of a story. We take we go out and we play famous Bethpage Black Golf Course, and a client of mine hires me to go coach him through a round of golf there, and through those 18 holes, we discover 18 challenges that are golf-related that need to be overcome, but then those challenges are also related to succeeding in business and in life.
And I love those kind of books where there's actually a story behind it. Some of three of my favorite books in the world are The Alchemist, The Greatest Salesman in the World, and The Ultimate Gift. And those are all told in story form, and it's a much different, more interesting experience to read something that way, I find, than just to, okay, here's four steps to do this.
Right. And people enjoy it much more. You know, Tom, one of the unique things about this book is that it's not targeted towards good golfers. It's not targeted towards new golfers or struggling golfers. It's targeted towards people that want to enjoy a golf story and relate it to business in life. So I've had a lot of people that actually don't even play golf, and they've used the book as a tool for helping them and motivate them to succeed in their business. And I've had them say that it was a fun read. They were able to read it in one night, 3 to 4 hours. It's 160 some odd pages, so they really enjoyed that aspect of it, that it was a story, and it wasn't a drudgery of PowerPoint tips or things that they had to do.
Nice. Yeah, because people get tired of those, and as you said, there's all kinds of golf books with the 1, 2, 3 steps of doing this or that. But I find that more of your emotion and your imagination gets involved when you read it in a story format than just like a lecture format.
absolutely. So it was fun to write, and we were just getting great reviews.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for your time today, Scott. So interesting how you've been able to take what was at first just a definite purpose involving golf and expand it so greatly, and use some great skills, writing and coaching and speaking. And what an interesting topic. You don't find too many business people that won't engage in a conversation about golf, that's for sure. So good luck this coming year with all your various projects, and just thank you so much for joining me today.
Yes, thank you, Tom. And I'd just like to say I enjoy following you and your blogs and posts. And although you say you're only 5'1", I think your courage stands much taller.
Thanks so much, Scott. Have an amazing 2013.
Thank you. You as well.